Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where
prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to our series on key battles in the Revolutionary War. In the last episode, we were setting the stage for the Battle of Bunker Hill. Found out that it really didn't take place on Bunker Hill. It actually took place on Breed's Hill. But if you call it the Battle of Breed's Hill, nobody will know what you're talking about. James, we're not going to be that guy who insists on calling it Breed's Hill, are we?
No, who are we to break tradition? Let's just go with the tradition.
Exactly. I mean, if you want to be the most obnoxious person in the world, someone chimes in with Bunker's Hill, you can say, well, actually, you know, a sentence is going to go great when it starts out with, well, actually. But let's just get right into it. We talked all about what was happening. The British were landing their forces. They were preparing for the assault on the American fortifications, which, well built in a limited amount of time, were rather small. And we're going to see what happens. And the British are very confident that they can charge up a hill and stamp out this insurrection where it stands.
Yeah. So, listener, if you probably should go back and listen to our previous episode if you haven't yet, because it'll make this will make a lot more sense. But I will just give a little bit more. I'll build on what Scott just said. So the British have decided to attack the Americans on the Charlestown Peninsula, which is a triangle, roughly triangle shaped peninsula north of Boston, which you can only reach from Boston by going across water. The Americans have built on top of Breed's Hill, which is roughly in the middle of the peninsula. They've built a little redoubt, which is kind of a small fort. In addition to that, they have other men going from the redoubt, going north all the way to the other body of water, which is the Mystic River. They've got some men behind a rail fence, which they fortified with straw and hay and rocks and other things. And then they've got other men behind a stone wall. So the Americans are prepared. They're ready to go. They're all at least behind some kind of defensive fortification. The British are going to try to come up from the east. They've landed about 1,600 troops, and then just for fun, they beefed it up with 700 more. So they've got a roughly 2,300 soldiers that are going to try to march. Some of them are going to hit the redoubt, but kind of as a diversion, but most of them are going to try to go to the north or above, if you use a map, above the redoubt and try to swing around behind it. So let's see how that goes.
All right. So first British charge.
First British charge, yes, and we already gave away something there, Scott. It's on there. The attentive listener is saying, first? That implies that there's going to be at least two, and that is right. So let's see what happens the first time. About 3 p.m., the reinforced British Army, again with about 2,200, 2,300 soldiers, they began to mount a bayonet charge toward the wall and the redoubt. General Howe personally led the attack on the rail fence, which was kind of in the middle of the American lines. If you think the American lines, if you're an American and you're behind the lines, if you're in the redoubt, you're on the right. If you're behind the rail fence, you're in the center. And if you're behind the stone wall, that's on the left, which is the north. It's sideways. Think of it as if you think of this triangle, and right in the middle of the triangle is the fort. Draw a line straight north of that, and that's the American line. The British are coming in another vertical line coming from the right side or the east.
And listeners, so, we have maps in the show notes, so check this out. Yeah, if that doesn't make sense.
I'm not feeling like I'm really doing a great job on the mental map this time.
No, but I mean, it is. If you look at the map, that is complicated. I don't know how you could do any better. So kudos to you for explaining what is pretty hard to put into words.
Yeah, thanks. I just try to make it in common geometric shapes like lines and triangles, and I'm oversimplifying. But anyway, so the British are marching along slow and steady, but they run into some problems. They literally run into things. They run into clay pits. They run and they fall in sometimes, or they stumble. They run into brick kilns. They run into fences. So I don't want our listeners to think that the field in between where the British had landed and where the Americans are is just wide open grassland. It's not. There's all kinds of junk. There's high grass, there's swamps, clay pits, like I said, and before long, there's going to be dead bodies that they're going to have to step over as the Americans begin to fire at them. And it was very hot, as I mentioned previously, or maybe it was in the last episode. Oh, and did I mention there's a fire? The town to the left of the British, to the right of the Americans, was Charlestown, and the British had blasted away at that to eliminate any possible snipers, and pretty much the whole town was on fire. So you've got fire adding to the heat, you've got smoke adding to the chaos, cutting down the visibility of the attackers, and the British soldiers are loaded down with gear.
These are very sweaty on that hill.
Yeah, and remember, these are wool uniforms, and they've got these hats on, these big hats, these tricorn hats, and they are not comfortable. They're hot, sweaty, and they're loaded down with backpacks and all kinds of stuff. Meanwhile, the Americans, the militiamen in the redoubt, they were under the command of a man named Colonel William Prescott. They were armed with smoothbore muskets, which had a very limited range. Definitely less than 100 yards, in some cases as little as 60 or 70 yards. And because they didn't have this great range, because they only had, as Scott mentioned, they didn't have a ton of ammo to start with, Colonel Prescott is believed to have said, "Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes, then fire low." And that's a famous line that everybody, almost every American, learns in school. Don't fire [S2] Yes. [S1] Until you see the whites of their eyes. In other words, don't waste any ammo by shooting at them when they're 150, 200 yards away. You're just going to miss. And fire low, because if you fire high, that doesn't do any good either. He also supposedly said, pick off the commanders. Go for the generals, or go for the colonels and the captains and the lieutenants and things like that. There's only, there may just one or two generals. Howe is in command of this. All right, so the rebels fired their first volley as the British got closer. 95 British were killed immediately. 95 just whoom, hit the deck, dead. And dozens more fell wounded. The charge halted, and New Hampshire Colonel John Stark, who is in command at the stone wall of the rail fence — I'm having a senior moment here — but he's not in the redoubt. He's north behind one of the walls. He said, "I never saw sheep lie as thick as in the folds." So he's just amazed by how many have already fallen. So the British, as they're marching up the hill or toward the rail fence or the stone wall, they undergo a withering fire, and they turned and ran. The British decided, well, you know, it's not worth that. It's not worth my life. So they turn around and run back. While the first redcoat charge was occurring, the Marines were struggling to get to the front of the redoubt. Hidden skirmishers picked off many, and they too retreated. Even the Marines retreated. So they don't usually do that. Well, this is not the U.S. Marines. These are the British Marines. But anyway, so the first charge ends in failure. They have to turn around and go back, and they're going to have to start over.
Yeah, this is this little episode here. If you, listener, are American or were educated in the United States, you almost definitely heard this story. I first heard it in fifth grade, then later in ninth grade when it was more fleshed out. My social studies teacher, Mr. Martin, talked about it, and I remember him bellowing out the phrase, "Disperse, ye rebels, disperse." So when you were describing that in an earlier episode, James, I had Mr. Martin saying that. Mr. Martin's explanation of "don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes," his take on it was somehow the Americans were the first people to understand that you need to use your weapons in the way that they were designed and take advantage of their limited range. That before Americans, people would just fire in no discernible direction whatsoever without any hope of hitting it. And then the Americans were the first to figure out, oh, wait, what if we wait until they're closer and then we can aim and fire? Dear listener, the Americans were not the first ones to figure this out. This goes a little bit further back in military history. Also, the other thing Mr. Martin taught me was that the Americans were the first to come up with guerrilla combat, and they just mowed down British in simple lines. James and I have already debunked that. So what I just want to underline here, if you have been taught that erroneous fact, the takeaway here isn't that Americans figured out how to use weapons within their proper range. That's fairly common sense. There wasn't any sort of military genius. I suppose we could credit them with bravery that they were waiting until troops within close range to fire when they had limited ammunition, when they themselves did not have bayonets, and when their opponents did have bayonets. And if you were skittish, you may have fired early, but you almost certainly would have missed. But then if you waited, you could have a better shot. Kudos to them for bravery, but it's not some masterstroke of military genius. That's my take. Do you have any alternate take on that, James?
No, that sounds good to me.
Okay. So the first charge fails. The British just pack up and go home back to Britain and America. Yeah. So
yeah, they just say, nah, never mind. No, actually, they decided to try again. So General Howe bravely reforms the troops. He leads another charge up the hill, this time with more men. And as they're marching up that hill and toward that rail fence and the stone wall, the militiamen shoot down 240 of them. Ooh. Now, those weren't all killed. Some of them were wounded, but quite a few of them were killed. And again, that was just too much for the British to deal with. They couldn't keep going. So again, they retreated back down the hill.
Yeah, and like you said, this is a hill with holes and fences hidden in the grass. So this is almost as much of an impediment as the hostile fire.
Yeah, they're tripping over stuff, and the horror is that in some cases they're stepping on bodies, they're stepping in people's guts, and sorry people if that's gross, but I mean that's war. They're tripping over corpses, and it's just really, it's getting really ugly for the British. In fact, Howe's entire staff was killed, and he later wrote, "There was a moment I never felt before." So the Americans are showing that they're not a bunch of wimps. You know, they may not be the professional, full-time, awesome force that the British Army was, but they know how to fire a gun. They're not going to just break and run just because they see bayonets glinting in the sun and red uniforms. Howe, at this point, summons several hundred more men from Boston, British soldiers. When they arrive, he leads a third charge. And this time, he decides to put more emphasis on the redoubt itself. And again, he leads this one personally. This time, he had a great idea, Scott. He said, let's take off our heavy packs.
You know, maybe
maybe we can get up there a little bit faster and not be quite so tired. So, and this was going to be a bayonet-only assault. No firing along the way. And you know, that's got to be scary, Scott, because imagine you're a soldier and you're marching up this hill slowly. And, I mean, you're going to want to fire, especially when the Americans let it rip, right? When they start firing on you, your gut reaction is you want to fire back, but they're ordered not to fire. They're just going to march up there, get up there as fast as they can, and just start bayoneting people, get into the redoubt and get over the walls. Now, the militiamen have a major problem, and that is that they're running out of ammo. Scott and I both mentioned how they didn't have much. Now they are about to have zero. They had expended 13,000 musket balls, 13,000 in the first two charges. Some militiamen had to throw rocks at the British. That's not very good, you know. They've got bayonets and bullets, and you're hitting them with rocks. On the third charge, as I mentioned, Howe focused entirely on the redoubt rather than on the redoubt and the stone wall and the rail fence. And as the soldiers marched, they shouted, "Fight, conquer, or die. Fight, conquer, or die." That must have been pretty unnerving for the Americans, especially when they're staring at a musket with no ammo. And not surprisingly, with the Americans unable to pour fire into the British as they did the first two times, on this third charge, British soldiers, they get into the redoubt. In fact, they pour into the redoubt. One American officer wrote this. He said, "I cannot pretend to describe the horror of the scene within the redoubt. 'Twas streaming with blood and strewed with dead and dying men, the soldiers stabbing some and dashing out the brains of others. We tumbled over the dead to get at the living who were crowding out of the gorge of the redoubt." So the militiamen in the redoubt and at the stone wall and the fence, they retreat. And this is not a rout, okay? This is not run for your life as fast as you can, throw away your musket and just skedaddle. This was an organized retreat, and John Stark deserves a lot of credit for that. They marched back onto Bunker Hill, where they were supposed to have been in the first place and probably should have stayed, but no, they didn't. They didn't listen to orders. Somebody had a great idea. And anyway, they finally marched even further to the west, off the peninsula altogether. Some were left behind in the redoubt, and of these, 30 were bayoneted to death by the British soldiers. And the man I mentioned earlier, Major General Joseph Warren, also Dr. Joseph Warren, he was also killed in this third charge. So very sad moment. He's mentioned by name in the series, John Adams. John Adams mentions that General Warren has been killed. This is a big blow because he was really seen as somebody as a rising star, somebody with a great amount of potential. I've heard people say that had he lived, we might have never heard of George Washington today. I don't know if that's true or not, but yeah, because he might have been made the overall commander. But alas, that's not how things worked out. He instead is killed. And as I said, the British bayoneted some of the wounded to death. The British were not messing around. You know, they were not always chivalrous and kind, and they weren't good sports.
I think, James, a long time ago, you requested I do a mini episode on the training of a soldier in the Revolutionary period versus the modern military. Yes. A modern soldier would absolutely obliterate a revolutionary soldier. They're trained in hand-to-hand combat weapons. Yeah. They're in better shape. The few ways that a soldier in this period would be trained, they would know how to load a weapon. They would fire about as quickly as you could, 3 shots a minute. They would also study bayonet fencing, because there was an understanding that with close quarter combat, this is what you would use. So for all the lack of professionalism in some aspects, the lack of physical conditioning these soldiers would have, they would have proficiency on how to bayonet someone to death. So this is horrific. I just want to underline that if you didn't already enough.
Yeah, and we're going to see examples in the future of people being bayoneted 5, 6, 7 times or even more. It's the British, like I said, they don't mess around with those bayonets. They know, as you said, they know what to do and they use them. They're not afraid to use them, as the saying says. So the battle ends in a British victory. The British are the victors. They're the winner of the battle because they, at the end of the battle, they hold the field of battle. The Americans had to retreat. But it's a very costly, very, very costly victory, Scott.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So shall we go straight into the aftermath?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. The Americans left 140 dead, 271 wounded, and 30 missing. And one of the casualties, as I mentioned, was Major General Joseph Warren. So a very high-ranking officer, although he was just brand new. He had just gotten his commission. The British, I think they wanted to pursue the Americans further west, but they were too exhausted. They lost 226 dead and 828 wounded. And of the wounded, about 250 would die of their wounds. So we're talking, what is that? I do a little math here. Over 1,000 casualties, and about 500 almost are going to end up dead. So the British losses were almost 50% of their initial strength. That is a huge casualty rate. You know, when we went through our Civil War series, I believe the highest casualty rate we saw was 33%. I think it was which battle was that? It was like Stone's River or Murfreesboro, or I don't know, it was one of the ones in Tennessee. I've forgotten. I've read so much Revolutionary War that I forgot some of the details. But so if you think about, as bloody as the Civil War was, the highest casualty rate as a percentage was 33%. Well, here the British lose 50%. So can you say Pyrrhic victory, Scott?
Yeah, that's ugly. And I would just like to take a moment here to highlight something you mentioned and not skip over, because this could maybe broaden our perspective on history or military history. You're absolutely right. That's a very high casualty rate, but think about that, 50%, and it's rare to get that high. One of the greatest victories of the French in the Hundred Years' War with the British was the Battle of Agincourt. Or I'm sorry, that was the British victory of 30 to 50% of French soldiers. Warfare, it's not the type of thing where every last man is wiped out like a Battle of Thermopylae, that really doesn't happen. I mean, it very, very rare situations, and we know of them because they're so rare. And that's because, as we saw in this battle, and in almost all battles we can think of militarily, the point isn't to, you know, spill the blood of every last man on the soil. As a general or as a commander, your goal is to win. And you weaken an army or you weaken it until it loses formation. Then it'll retreat. Maybe you can catch them in a rout or at least force them into a retreat. Maybe they surrender. You don't want to wipe them off the face of the earth. The cases where you see the highest amounts of casualties, this is one example, but when soldiers run away and it gets into a rout, that's where you see the highest amount of casualties happen. And the reason more patriots didn't die is because it wasn't. Fun fact, I read something by this blogger on military affairs named John Davis, who said, at boot camp, the reason soldiers are yelled at so much by officers, it's partly discipline, yes, but it's also to rewire your brain so that you don't immediately trigger into a fight or flight response when something sudden and eruptive happens at you, whether it's a drill sergeant screaming in your face or it's gunfire going off. And ultimately, you're trained when you're attacked to run toward the source of the fire, and you actually have a better chance of surviving. That goes against every hardwired instinct you have as a human being. Your instinct is to run away, but you're reprogrammed in boot camp to get away from it so you don't get into a rout-like situation and have those high casualty numbers. So that's my little meta commentary, but let's come back down to earth. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Yeah, that's interesting, Scott. I didn't know that about the yelling. And so you get used to loud noises and chaos and disruption that, and you train yourself not to run away. When I went and got my first master's degree, there was a guy in one of my classes, and he'd been in the Navy, and we were talking about the military, and he said, I don't know why they always think you have to yell to motivate people. Why do they always yell? And so now I know the answer.
Right. I mean, there's live fire exercises, but yelling is cheaper and it's omnipresent, and it's a great way to let off steam if you're a drill sergeant. So it's just more effective.
Yeah, it's too bad I'm not in contact with this guy anymore. I could say, hey, Dr. Scott Rank said such and such. Anyway, all right. So regarding the casualties, General Howe, of course, he was the leader of the attack. He said, the success is too dearly bought. And General Gage, who was in overall command, he had stayed behind in Boston. He wrote, the trials we have had to show that the rebels are not, I'm sorry, let me reemphasize that. The trials we have had show that the rebels are not the despicable rabble too many have supposed them to be. In all their wars against the French, they never showed so much conduct, attention, and perseverance as they do now. In other words, in modern parlance, Gage is saying, these guys they're not wimps. they're tougher than we thought they were.
We're braver than the French, ladies and gentlemen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Why didn't they fight like this against the French? They're fighting. They're giving us everything they got. One of the American commanders at this point, he's just a brigadier general of militia, New Hampshire militia, a man named Nathaniel Green. He's going to have a big future. We'll talk a lot about Green in the future. But at this point, Green says he was at the battle. He said, I wish we could sell them another hill at the same price. In other words, yeah, you want another hill? That's fine. We'll take another 1,000 guys with us. The carnage shocked everyone. even battle-hardened veterans, you know, people like Gage and Howe, and they just couldn't believe how fiercely the Americans had fought. You know, it helped that they were behind fortifications, but it wasn't just the fortifications. It was there was a fighting spirit that the British just had not seen coming. The Americans also learn a valuable lesson about the importance of supply lines. Yes. You know, you've got to have a clear chain of supplies coming to you, or you might run out of ammo. You know, imagine, Scott, if the Americans had not run out of ammo, we might be talking about American victory at this point. And another thing about this battle, Bunker Hill or Breed's Hill, if you prefer, it was the most costly battle of the entire war for the British in terms of the number killed and wounded. So obviously the British don't know this at the time, nor do the Americans. But looking back on it, we can say the British would never lose this many men again in another battle. And there's going to be a lot of battles.
Yeah, and another aspect of this, there's a difference with how the Patriots fight in this battle versus Lexington and Concord, and that has to do with the leadership that they had. One thing is that the marksmanship is much better than the retreat from Concord. Couldn't be much worse. That'd be almost impossible. But part of the reason is that the troops are fighting in tight formations, and they're commanded by competent officers that help direct what they're doing. Don't fire until you see the whites of their eyes. They have competent instruction. If they wouldn't have had that, then there could have been skittish firing when they're still a couple of hundred feet off, and we wouldn't have been talking about this costly victory. But a large number of the men in various militia organizations had backed away from the fight or chosen not to engage, as you mentioned, where many don't come back after the initial bombardment. A lot of the officers on the Patriot side are still untrained. Despite that, the officers here, the Patriot officers, have been given a very difficult task and did excellent under the circumstances, I would say, due to them almost achieving victory and the British having to fight a pyrrhic victory. Like you said, it was due to supply problems, lack of ammunition, and it took some time to sort out good officers from the bad, kind of like the Union Army in the Civil War. So what happens next? Does the army get whipped into shape?
Yeah, it's about time to get organized. The Patriots realize it's not going to cut it just to have a bunch of individual militia units. We need a real army. We need a professional army along the lines of the British Army. So this is actually before Bunker Hill. This is 3 days before. The Battle of Bunker Hill takes place on June 17th, 1775. 3 days before that, down in Philadelphia on June 14th, the Congress voted to establish a Continental Army. So this is the beginning, the birth of the U.S. Army, or what would become the U.S. Army, for purposes of common defense and to also to fight the British. And so they adopted the forces already in place outside of Boston and New York. At the same time as this, the authorities, the new Patriot civilian authorities in New England, they yield control. So they surrender control of the troops around Boston and New York to the Continental Congress. So again, the Continental Congress is basically going to be the government. The government's going to be very, well, should I give that away? I'll go ahead and give it away. The government, the Congress is really going to struggle. They're going to have they're not going to be the most effective government ever in the history of the world. I mean, they'll basically get the job done, but there's going to be a lot of issues and problems that we're going to have. There's no president. There's no executive. There's no judiciary branch. There's just the Congress. There's going to be a committee that gives their orders to the army. There's no single commander in chief like we have today in the president. The Congress also votes to raise 10 companies of Continental troops on a one-year enlistment. That was very optimistic. They also recruit riflemen from Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, and Virginia to be used as light infantry, and they became the first Continental Regiment later on. And again, you do have – we talked earlier about how the overwhelming majority of soldiers in the Revolutionary War on both sides were – they used regular muskets, smoothbore muskets with a limited range. However, there are some riflemen. Rifles had been invented. The reason they weren't the standard issue weapon is because they were very hard to load. It was slow, much slower than a smoothbore musket, and the gunpowder would get stuck on the inside of the barrel, and it would take a long, sometimes you have to clean them out and you could have accidents. So rifles are around and they do have a longer range, but they're just not, they're just too high maintenance, Scott. You know, they're just too much of a pain. But nevertheless, there will be units of riflemen, and we'll talk about a couple of famous ones later. And then on June 15th, 1775, 2 days before Bunker Hill, the Congress elected by unanimous vote George Washington as commander-in-chief. Washington, when he arrived at the Continental Congress, when he went to the first meeting, he wore his old Virginia militia uniform. He didn't show up in civilian clothes. He walks in a military uniform. It's almost as if he's saying, ooh, ooh, pick me, advertising his services. At least that's my interpretation of it. So George Washington is chosen to be commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. He accepted, and he served throughout the war without any compensation. He refused a salary. All he said, if you'll just pay me back for my expenses, then I'll be happy. And he's going to run up a tab of thousands of pounds over the course of the war. But anyway, so there you go. John Adams was the one who nominated him. And when they do that in the John Adams miniseries, I think it's very accurate the way they portrayed that. So he's going to be lieutenant general. Again, they're not going to have any full generals like four-star. You won't have any of those until Ulysses S. Grant way later. But so Lieutenant General Washington is the head honcho, and then under him you're going to have four major generals. Later that will be expanded, but we start with Artemus Ward, who had been he's just about to be in the process of fighting Bunker Hill. He's the overall commander at Bunker Hill. A fellow named Charles Lee, and we will have much to say about Charles Lee. He's a piece of work. Do y'all have that phrase in where you live, Scott?
Work? It's I like to think of when a police officer is describing a juvenile delinquent.
Yeah.
He has a very interesting, there's a lot to, we'll get into
it's
it.
It's a polite way of saying he's a mess or worse. Another major general is going to be Philip Schuyler. He's a very wealthy New York resident, and he's going to end up being Alexander Hamilton's father-in-law, but more on that later. And then Israel Putnam, who is going to be at Bunker Hill. There's going to be eight brigadier generals. So we're putting together a command structure. Washington finally arrives at Boston, or in the vicinity of Boston, not in the town, of course, because that's where all the British soldiers are. But he arrives in the outskirts of Boston on July 2nd, so a couple weeks after Bunker Hill, to take command. And when Washington arrives, he's disturbed. He's disgusted. Disturbed is not strong enough. He's disgusted by the chaos and the wretched conditions. There's no discipline. People are getting drunk. People are running around swearing. And by the way, Washington despised swearing. He would fine people later for swearing. He would punish people. He wanted people to, you know, use nice language. The camps are filthy. People would just go to the bathroom wherever they felt like it. So there's literally crap everywhere. And it is just disgusting. And he realizes, all right, I've got to do something here. I've got to fix this. So he works to make the army more professional. He organizes the soldiers into Continental Regiment. He's trying to remove state identifications. He wants to not have the 1st Rhode Island Regiment and the 1st New Hampshire Regiment. He wants to just have mixed regiments. That doesn't work out, but at least he tries. Now, the problem with this is there were about 16,000 troops around Boston, but less than 10,000 of them agreed to enlist into the Continental Army, and they enlist for 1 year. And that's going to be a constant problem, Scott. Washington is going to be dogged throughout the war by people just saying, oh, my enlistment's over. I'm going to go home. You know, kind of like Forrest Gump, after he did that long run, he ran across the country several times, and he finally goes, I'm tired. I think I'll go home now. So these people say, oh, I'm sorry, we're tired. We're going to go home. Well, what about patriotism? What about your country? What about liberty? And I don't care. I'm going home.
Probably said it word for word like Forrest Gump said.
Yeah, maybe if they were from South Carolina or Georgia, perhaps.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, I think we have to talk a little bit about Washington. If any of you listened to a previous series that James and I did, a Presidential Fight Club, probably one of the best things that's ever happened in podcasting history. Don't want to toot my own horn too much or our horn
yes,
too much.
Yes, you must immediately after you finish this episode, go find it and listen to it. You'll love it, people.
I think it's a very unconventional take. Basically, it's all 44 presidents fighting each other one-on-one. Well, in that series, we got into a lot on what made Washington such a magnificent specimen. He's much taller than those around him, had incredible physical strength, could best much younger men in wrestling and fencing. He was a horseman. So many things about him, but there was an aura about him that some historians of the 19th century had a theory called the great man theory. Events in history are guided by those, whether through personal charisma, genius, divine providence, whatever you call it, are the ones that really bend the course of history. Not a very popular theory these days, but for those who are coming up in the 19th century, I like to think that they would have thought of Washington with that. And I just want to mention something very briefly from a biography on Washington called The Indispensable Man by James Flexner that came out in the 70s. And he describes Washington in this way. He was the glue that held the revolution together. Not only was he commander of the armies, though not without petty resentments from other generals, but he was the icon, the symbol of American resistance. If James Otis, Samuel Adams, and the Articles of Association drafted at the First Continental Congress were the sparks that ignited the Revolution, making possible Jefferson's Great Declaration, and if John Adams and Benjamin Franklin were the kindling that gave it legal and philosophical sustenance at its beginning, Washington was the wood. And as long as the fuel remained, the fire burned. So there you go. High words of praise for Washington. And I understand you have some other background information. So let's see. Do you think the details of his biography meet that grand description?
Oh, yeah. Let me say that I think that's a really good biography, especially as an introduction. So listener, if you want to read a biography of Washington, but you don't want to read several hundred pages, if you want to just read a couple hundred or 300, that's an excellent place to start. Flexner's Washington, the Indispensable Man. I read it. It's probably been 20 years now, but it's really good. We'll talk about another one a little bit later, another biography. But for now, let's do a mini bio of George Washington. As we go through this series, when we get to a major character, we will stop and sketch them out a little bit, give you their background, talk about what brought them to the point, you know, how they were formed, what you know, just their background and what made them the people they were at the beginning of the war. So Washington will probably get our longest one, and it's not going to be super long, just 3 more hours. So hang on there.
Dan Carlin length episode. Yeah.
Yeah. No kidding. That'd be like some other podcasts I know. Nobody mentioned, but, no, this will just be about probably 15 minutes or so. So, George Washington was born in 1732 in Northern Virginia. His father died when he was 11, and he was raised and educated by his mother and his brother Lawrence. He never got much of a formal education, though. He just didn't have the chance. He got involved in working very early on, and there were some money issues. From age 16 to 18, he worked as a surveyor. So he went out and surveyed land claims, and he got to know the Virginia backcountry very well. When he was 17, he moved to his brother Lawrence's estate, which was called Mount Vernon. That was named after an admiral in the British Navy, by the way. Scott, I don't know if you knew that. I learned that recently.
I did not. Interesting.
Lawrence had served in the Navy, and he liked this admiral so much that he named his house after him. So Mount Vernon, George moves there as a young man, and his brother Lawrence dies in 1752. And this is an interesting thing about the Washington family. The men tended to die pretty early. You didn't see any septuagenarians or octogenarians. I mean, they would die in their 40s, maybe 50s if they were lucky. Lawrence got really sick and died in 1752. George is only 20. So he inherited Lawrence's position as a major in the Virginia militia, as well as his estate. So here is where George's military career begins. Within 2 years, he had been promoted lieutenant colonel. But before that, the governor of Virginia sent Washington out. This is 1754, so Washington is 22 years old, very young man. And he sends Washington to clear the French out of the Ohio country, and we could do a huge long thing on this. Virginia claimed the Ohio country, which is to the west. It's much of what is the modern state of Ohio, but other parts as well. Washington and his force of 100 were surrounded, and they were sent back home by the superior French force at the forks of the Ohio. So Washington's job was, as a super young man, was to go and tell these French, go away. And the French said, no, you go away. So he went away. A year later, the British government sent regular troops to the colonies. And by the way, this is the beginning of what we call the French and Indian War. In Europe, it was called the Seven Years' War. So Washington goes along with this outfit. It's a bigger group of soldiers. They're led by a general this time, Edward Braddock. Washington serves on his staff as a volunteer. They march to Fort Duquesne, but they were ambushed at the Battle of the Monongahela, which I've mentioned in passing before. General Braddock was killed, but Washington helped rally the survivors, and he led them back to Virginia. There's several other future Revolutionary War big shots that were in this battle. General Gage was in it. He wasn't a general at the time, but Thomas Gage, a man named Horatio Gates, we'll talk about him later, so as well as others. So Washington becomes a hero, but he's the guy who, you know, made the best of the situation and brought the troops back to Virginia safely, even though it was a loss. Washington desperately wanted to get a commission in the regular British Army, but they just wouldn't give it to him. He just couldn't talk them into making him a regular British officer. Scott, can you imagine?
That's an interesting counterfactual history of what would have happened. Yeah.
Yeah. What if they, guys, if you had just made Washington an officer in the British Army, maybe you wouldn't have had this revolution, but, or maybe you would have won it. But anyway, that's not what happened. And so Washington, for a long time, is going to carry kind of a chip on his shoulder because they wouldn't take him. They rejected him. In 1759, he marries Martha Custis, a very wealthy widow. And this makes him immediately shoots him up in the ranks of the wealthiest people in Virginia. He takes a seat in the House of Burgesses and he leaves the militia. He lives as a wealthy farmer running a plantation. He owns a couple hundred slaves. He's raising tobacco and other crops. And during the time when he is working on his plantation, he becomes increasingly disillusioned with the British government. As we've seen, we saw in our very first episode, the British government enacted a series of taxes, and these hit the people of Virginia just as badly as they did the people of Boston, which we focused on. They also restricted Western settlement. In 1763, they issued a proclamation saying you couldn't settle or have any land west of the Appalachian Mountains, and that caused Washington to lose a lot of land that he had claimed. So Washington is becoming increasingly anti-British. In 1774, he was selected as a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He didn't really make a lot of waves there. And then in 1775, as we have seen, the governor of, I think we mentioned this, Scott, the governor of Virginia, Lord Dunmore, made a proclamation or issued a proclamation, and he promised to free any slaves who would run away to British lines. He even organized some of the runaways into an Ethiopian regiment, and he did have several hundred run away. This proclamation struck terror into the hearts of the Virginia gentry. This is really going to rock your world if you're a big slave owner like Washington was. Or there's others like Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee. So that makes the elite of Virginia, the leaders of the colony, it makes them even more anti-British. And as we've seen, Washington was elected to the Second Continental Congress. And as I mentioned, he wore his old militia uniform to the meetings. He was put in charge of a committee to build defenses of New York City and then another committee to help supply the army. And then, as we saw, he was offered overall command of the Continental Army. Washington was a very humble man. He said, I this day state with the utmost sincerity, I do not think myself equal to the command I am honored with. But he took it anyway. I think he really wanted it. I don't know if this was false humility. I mean, I think he probably thought he was up to the task, but I think he did realize it was going to be a hard thing, because remember, he'd never been more than a lieutenant colonel. He'd commanded Virginia militia throughout the war, the previous war, but he had not led a gigantic army like he was about to be doing. And he, as you mentioned before, he was a very impressive man. He was over 6 feet tall. I've heard everything between 6'0 and 6'2. Very strong, had incredibly powerful arms and legs. Probably would have been, he would hit if they'd had the Highland Games back then, he would have won it. He would have been one of these power lifters or something. But anyway, but they didn't have that. But everybody that saw him just could not help but be impressed by him. Let me give you one example. There was a doctor and a patriot leader, Benjamin Rush. Benjamin Rush keeps popping up everywhere. He's in the John Adams series all throughout. This is what Rush wrote. He said, Washington, quote, has so much martial dignity in his deportment that you would distinguish him to be a general and a soldier from among 10,000 people. There is not a king in Europe that would not look like a valet de chambre by his side.
Ooh.
In other words, you know, a butler, basically a chamber valet. So that's pretty, pretty amazing quote there. And then finally, Washington arrives in the army. And when he appeared, Nathaniel Greene, he wrote, joy was visible on every countenance. And it seemed as if the spirit of conquest breathed through the whole army. So just by showing up, Washington lifted the spirits of the army, but he's going to have a big job ahead of him.
Hey everyone, Scott here. One more brief word from our sponsors.
Are you a man who thinks about the Roman Empire at least once a day? According to a recent internet meme, you definitely do. And why shouldn't you? Here's a clip from Tom Holland talking about Rome at the very height of its power.
When tourists go to the Colosseum, they're not really going there, I suspect, most of them, because they're admirers of Flavian architecture. I suspect that they're going there because it's the kind of the shiver that you get of going to a place where blood sports have happened.
To listen to more of this discussion, check out the History Unplugged podcast on the podcast player of your choice.
This episode is brought to you by Calitrin. Text the word unplugged to 30605, and I'll send you a link to a wonderful product that can help you finally succeed in shedding that extra weight. I took Calitrin for several weeks last year, and I felt great in several ways. I felt stronger, my workouts felt easier, I slept better, I was noticeably trimmer, there was no downside. Text the word unplugged to 30605 right now to see this week's special offer on Calitrin. Calitrin contains collagen, the most abundant protein naturally occurring in the human body, which decreases as we age. Taking Calitrin promotes better sleep, more energy, less joint pain, and best of all, weight loss. Calitrin has an 86% success rate with their 90-day supply, and this week, take advantage of my special offer. Buy the 90-day supply and get an extra month free, plus free shipping. Ordering is easy. Just text the word unplugged to 30605, and I'll send you a link to the special offer. Again, text unplugged to 30605.
So he's sort of like some opponents of Napoleon would say, if he was present in the battle, it was like having an extra 10,000 troops there. Or like Gandalf at the Siege of Gondor, who's able to inspire hope in the troops when the Witch King is there.
I think, absolutely.
Maybe Tolkien references will be the thing.
We've got to work Tolkien into every episode.
Yeah, I made a few here, so hey, we'll just keep going.
Very good. But as I always tell my students, you know, these militia units that were around Boston, they were declared to be the Continental Army and they were enlisted in the Continental Army. But I always tell my students, just because you give them a title, I say, I could proclaim myself the commander in chief of the San Jacinto College Army and you guys are in the army. You're my soldiers now, but that doesn't make you automatically a better soldier, does it? And they go, no. There's no magic wand that you can wave and turn these guys into a great army. Washington's going to have a huge task ahead of him.
Right. I would say one other thing there with titles. We mentioned this in the Civil War series as well, when we have these battlefield commissions and brevet officers. Remember, this is in the 18th century when you have Habsburg dynasties and meaningless titles. The best corollary I can think of this, when titles are just flowing like wine to people who may or may not deserve it, go to a college campus and go to administrators. Oh, I am the vice dean of undersecretary faculty of sustainability. Oh, what does that mean? Oh, I take out the recycling cans. So,
yeah, I know.
But I understand you have a story about Washington as father of the American mule. So I'm very curious about this.
Yeah, this... This is a great, I was just listening to this today. I'm currently listening to the biography of Washington by Ron Chernow. And this is an amazing biography. It won the Pulitzer Prize in 2010. And it really, it's considered, I think, pretty unanimously by most people today to be the definitive one volume biography of Washington that's out there today. Real pleasure to listen to. Let me read a little passage from there. So listener, just stick around for a few more minutes. You're going to love this. So he's talking about Washington. He says, perhaps nothing better illustrated Washington's pioneering farm work than his development of the American mule, a hardy animal representing a cross between a male donkey, also called a jack, and a female horse. Mules were less fragile than horses, but more docile than donkeys and cheap to maintain. Before Washington championed these creatures, they had hardly existed in the country. He started breeding them when he received a gray jack from the King of Spain called this, by the way, this happens after the war. So I'm out of sequence here, but anyway, work with me, called Royal Gift, and a black jack called Knight of Malta from Lafayette. Royal Gift was big and lumbering and lacking in animal spark, whereas Knight of Malta was small, but lusty. Washington cunningly and lusty. I like that. Washington cunningly bred the two animals and ended up with a jack known as Compound that merged the size of Royal Gift with the feisty nature of Knight and Malta. After some difficulties, the resulting donkeys settled down and performed their duties, producing 57 mules at Mount Vernon by century's end and enabling Washington to realize his hope to secure a race of extraordinary goodness that will stock the country. So in addition to his better-known title of Father of His Country, Washington is also revered in certain circles as the father of the American mule. Isn't that great?
Wow.
He's a man of many talents, you know, great general, great president, but also the father of the American mule. Who would have known?
And mules are sterile, so you have to keep stoking the fires of mule reproduction to keep them supplied. So I don't know if he inspired all of this breeding going through the colonies, but if you can inspire people to make mules, that's leadership right there. I am impressed. I'm impressed in a way I never would have been before. All right. Well, great. That is our overview of Bunker Hill. And in the next episode, we're going to be coming to our third battle, Key Battle 3, the Quebec Campaign and Knox's Cannon Run. See you there. Okay, so that is all for today. That's today's episode. Thank you for joining me. As always, I want to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, especially our spy masters, Todd Warren, Jake Harrington, Beverly Ingle, Bill Ivey, Joyce Norman, Tyler from Colorado, Josh Reddick, Baron Fraser, Chris from Maine, Carl from Norway, Moondoggy from Ohio, Rick Knowlton, Vic and Irene, Mike from New York, Michelle, and Marlene. I'll explain what that is in a second. If you like the show and want to help it grow, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, like and subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice. This helps spread the word about the show. Two, join our Facebook group. Here we can keep the discussion going about new episodes, and you can talk about what you like and didn't like. And you can find this group if you just search for History Unplugged on Facebook. Three, we have an online store with t-shirts, phone covers, and other accessories featuring awesomely bad history puns that were crowdsourced by you, the audience. And you can find that if you go to teepublic.com and look for History Unplugged, or you just go to historyonthenet.com and look for our store there. Four, and this is really the best way to dive deep with History Unplugged, and that's to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you know your American history, you know the Knowlton's Rangers were an elite spy and reconnaissance group in the American Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program of History Unplugged. You can join at three levels. If you join at the level of Scout, you can hear all the episodes of History Unplugged completely ad-free and get early access to new episodes, at least a week early. If you join at the Intelligence Officer level, you get special bonus episodes, like a 10-part series on the World War II hero Audie Murphy, a multi-part series called Ottoman Lives about different people in the Ottoman Empire, and a series called Rendezvous with Death that looks at biographical profiles of Americans who went to fight in World War I before America entered the war. The last level is Spymaster, where you get all that stuff, but you also get three hardcover history books, Forging a President, How the Wild West Created Teddy Roosevelt, Race to the Top of the World, Richard Byrd and the First Flight to the North Pole, and The Last Fighter Pilot, the true story of the final combat mission of World War II. Another bonus is, you can choose a history topic for me to focus on for an entire episode that can go up to an hour, and I'll answer whatever question you have for me, and you get a shout-out at the end of each episode. If you want to learn how to become a member of the Knowlton's Rangers,
go to patreon.com/unplugged. That's patreon.com/unplugged. All right, well, that is all for my spiel. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast, from ancient Greece to the Cold War and everything else in between. See you next time.